This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May Allah's peace and blessings be on each and every one of you. This evening's presentation, which begins a series of lectures, is on my way to Islam. And I hope to share with you my personal experiences which led me to the religion of Islam, not so much as a historical account of events, but more so from the point of view that there are lessons that may be learned from those in the audience who are Muslims, who may learn from my experience how Islam may be distorted and how it should be presented. And for those in the audience who may be non-Muslims, perhaps some of the things which I reflected on, some of the experiences which I went through, are shared experiences. And perhaps it would cause them to reflect as I reflected and have a look at Islam as a viable alternative to whatever systems or beliefs they now hold. I was born in Jamaica, which is an island. I'm sure most of you know about it. It seems to be most important for reggae in the world of music, and rum for those who are into drugs. It is also known as an area of tourism. At any rate, I was born in a Christian family. My mother was an Anglican, my father a Presbyterian, and my father's father was one of the leading church scholars there in Jamaica. He had learned Greek and Hebrew and was quite a figure. I didn't spend much time in Jamaica. My parents migrated to Canada when I was quite young. So I really don't have too many recollections of religion beyond, as a child, not wanting to put the penny in the plate. You know, we all were given coins to take to church, and when the plate was passed around, you had to put the penny or whatever in the plate. And I remember doing so because, of course, parents were there and you couldn't put it in your pocket, but doing so quite reluctantly and wondering to myself, why are we doing this? I would much prefer to use it to buy some candy or something else. At any rate, my parents migrated to Canada. What I can recall of growing up in Canada, primary and secondary education, is having to go swimming naked. This is what has left the biggest impression on me. That all the way through junior high school and high school, all the boys had to go swimming naked. You weren't allowed to swim with swimming trunks unless you had a special permit, you know, something from the doctor, the support of your family, to get you out of it. So we all had to go swimming naked. And of course, showers after gym. It was just a big hall with shower heads, and everybody showered naked. I felt shy about it. I couldn't really understand why we had to do it, but this is what we had to do. Much later in life, I came to realize that that there was a philosophy behind this. So something being introduced as a means of breaking down the feelings of shyness that people naturally hold to exposing themselves in front of others. And it was a product of the Darwinian approach to sociology, psychology, wherein feelings of shyness are looked at as being sickness, a sign of some kind of mental problem. Since animals are not shy, we don't find dogs and cats, etc., being shy of being naked amongst their kind. Why should human beings be shy? At any rate, with regards to Christianity, during my primary and secondary levels of education, Christianity was Sunday school. Sunday school was where you met girls and arranged parties. So, in terms of religious instruction, I guess it was going on, but most of us as children or young people were oblivious to it. In terms of Islam, what I saw of Islam during that period, what I can remember, there was one song called Ahab the Arab. Later on I came to find there was no Arabic name called Ahab. There's no Arabs by the name of Ahab, but this was the name of the song, Ahab the Arab, Sheikh of the Burning Sands. You know, this is what I remember. Cartoons, the image of that Arab riding on the camel with his sword in one hand and the Quran in the other, you know. You either accept this Quran or you lose your head. This was the image. And in terms of reading, the only reading material I can remember really is the Thousand and One Nights, which was basically a book of pornography, you know, about the sexual lives of the sultans and the caliphs. My family, after I completed high school, migrated to Malaysia. My parents were there with the Colombo Plan. Both of my parents were teachers, and they were there helping the Malaysian government in their educational program. There, my friends were mainly expats. And I can honestly say that there was no visible signs of Islam in the society. Beyond, the impression which was made very clear to us as expats, that you don't mess with Malay girls, otherwise you'll get killed. You know, this is basically the... it was no connection with Islam, it was just Malay, really. I must say that later on, years later, after becoming a Muslim and making Hajj, and I remember seeing a number of people there in Mecca and in Medina wearing these white coverings. And these women, they look like the same people I saw in Malaysia. But I'd never seen anybody like that, dressed like that. And I remember asking some of my friends there, you know, who are these people? They said, they're from Malaysia. I said, well, I never saw anybody like that. Well, they explained to me that in Malaysia, you know, the women didn't dress like that. Just as I saw them was how they dressed, you know, wearing the cultural garments that they wore. And they would carry their Islamic dress in a bag to the mosque, if they went to the mosque, and then they would put it on when they went inside the mosque. So I never saw that garb because people didn't wear it openly in the society. During this period, my mother and father adopted an Indonesian boy whose name was Aus Sulaiman. His name was contracted to Westman. He was born in Malaysia, but was from Indonesian parentage. And because of the fact that at the time, and it may still be the same policy, I don't know, that Indonesians who are born in Malaysia would not be given an opportunity for higher education, you know, beyond high school A levels. They wouldn't be given a chance to go to university, colleges. So my mother had taken a liking to this particular boy and was concerned about the fact that he didn't have any future and wanted to take him to Canada so that he would be able to continue his education. But the Canadian government insisted that the only way that he could be taken was if he was adopted. So my parents adopted him. And myself, my brother and sister lived together with him for some years there in Malaysia before going to Canada. Now, here was a Muslim element in my family, but which had no real impression on me because of the fact that my adopted brother, and of course I should mention that according to Islamic law, adoption is not permissible, but at any rate, this is what happened. His father was dead and my parents took him in, and his name was changed. His family name was changed to our family name. But he was a quiet and shy Muslim. He never said anything to us about Islam. Sometimes we'd open his room door, and you know, if he was happened to be praying near the door, you know, the door would bounce him in the head whilst he was in prostration. You know, we'd close back the door and speak to ourselves and say, you know, what's going on? What is he doing in there? You know, we'd wonder. Is there? We'd see him on the ground, you know, with his head on the ground. But we were ourselves embarrassed to ask him about it, and he never said anything to us. So, though he was Muslim within the family, if my mother was preparing food and, you know, we all ate pork, well, she prepared fish for him. We understood that he was eating different things than we ate. And during the month of Ramadan, my mother would get up early and prepare suhoor for him. So he fasted. He fasted, he prayed. You know, he did his basic Islam in the family, but he never said anything to us. For myself, while going to school there, I got involved in music. I came to be known at that time as the Jimi Hendrix of Sabah, emulating his style of dress and the type of music that he used to play. So I had my own rock group there. And this was basically the focus of my life until I finished off high school and decided to go back to Canada to further my education on a tertiary level, which is in university. I was accepted in University of Simon Fraser, and there I went to do a degree in biochemistry. Simon Fraser University at the time was one of the more experimental universities in the sense that they were introducing the credit hour system, which was not followed by the other universities across the country. They were following the British system of a single course throughout the year. And at the same time, what you found there was there was a really great looseness in the whole structure of the university. And there were a number of American students in this university who had come up to the university, and their ideas were influencing the students at the university. And what we found there is that in the liberal arts program, sociology, the humanities, sociology, psychology, and anthropology, the professors were from the Timothy Leary school. So I don't know if you know who Timothy Leary is, but he's an individual. He just died a few months back and had his remains shot out into space on a rocket. Timothy Leary was the discoverer of LSD, psychedelic drugs. At any rate, these professors, following the same tradition of Timothy Leary, used to begin classes by passing out a bag of marijuana. And after everybody had smoked up, then discussion began. So As I said, Simon Fraser was quite different from most universities at the time, and the situation there was quite fluid. At the same time, what was going on was there was a subtle introduction of ideas of communism in the minds of the students, you know, in these type of courses. I mean, though my major was biochemistry, we had to take these other courses as electives. And these ideas of communism were being introduced as they would guide and provide leadership for that student revolt. Eventually, the campus, Simon Fraser University campus, was shut down. Students took it over, took over the administration. And of course, the protest at the time was against the Canada's involvement with America in the Vietnam War. During this period, I was directly involved, and I began a conversion to what may be called revolutionary politics. I scrapped Christianity because it was really something which wasn't implemented in my life, so to speak. I mean, if somebody asked me, were you a Christian, I guess up to that point I would have said, yes, I was a Christian. But what it meant to be a Christian, that was left to the individual's interpretation. And I guess that's basically the way it is for most people today who are Christians. During this period, I began to do a lot of reading in Marxist-Leninist literature, and I was exposed briefly to something of Islam through the autobiography of Malcolm X. However, his autobiography was read as a part of required reading. You know, for you to be a solid revolutionary in those days, you had to read certain books. You know, you just had to get through these books to be able to say, I read these books. So I read it amongst the books. I mean, there was some interesting information, probably regarding his early life, in terms of the type of racial injustices which existed in America, which awoken me more, along with other books of this type, to the oppression which existed in Western society, and made me more open to embrace the communist ideal of a just society, communist banners of equality, justice, and fair distribution of wealth, etc., was very attractive at that time. So I converted to communism. I dropped out of school, finished off basically what was called an associate degree, 2 years in biochemistry. And from there, I left Canada and went down to the States, because this was where revolutionary activities were taking place. I joined a group there in Los Angeles and San Francisco, known as the Soledad Defense Committee, which was basically involved in gathering funds for a court case which was going on at the time for both the Soledad brothers as well as Angela Davis, because she was imprisoned at the time. What I noted, I had gone down there with a lot of ideals about communism and its implementation. What I noted was that there were a number of discrepancies in terms of the morality of the people involved. After one rally, where we had marched with placards and everything through the city, and there was a set of donations collected and taken back to the headquarters, I wanted to buy a pack of cigarettes. I didn't have any more money. And I said to the person who was there in the office, you know, if they could lend me some money to buy a pack of cigarettes. They said, oh, it's okay. They pulled open the drawer, and out of the donation box, they gave me some money to buy cigarettes. I took it and went and bought the cigarettes, but something struck me. How could this be that we were gathering this money to help these people's legal cause, and then they so easily would take from this money to give me to buy cigarettes. And they told me, it's okay, you know, we all get our basic things out of it. And I came to find out that, in fact, everybody's rent was being paid out of these funds. You know, people were buying cars for transportation. Parties were organized with these funds. You know, drugs and alcohol was bought with these funds. So, you know, it really bothered me. I continued with them, but this thing really struck at me and just left me really disheartened. And the final straw was at a major rally which was held in Los Angeles, where the leaders of the various organizations that were active at the time, the Black Panthers and others, got together. And everybody was just drunk at this. It was done at a big park, and people were just, you know, drunk out of their minds, you know, after a lot of talk, and then it was just a whole drunken scene. And to me, I mean, though I won't say I wasn't involved in drugs at the time also, like everybody else, but, you know, it was something like, you don't do this when you are involved in party activities and things like this. You know, it is sort of supposed to be controlled. I mean, that's how what people said. But the fact of the matter is that there was this just wide open lack of discipline amongst these people. And I felt inside myself that, you know, this was not going anywhere, really. I could see there was no real future in it. Probably one of the most popular books for standard reading at that time was a book called Soul on Ice. The person who wrote it, who was a member of the Black Panthers, he wrote this book, which was basically about raping white women. Right? This was what the book was about, how many different white women he raped. And it was presented in such a way that, you know, people were looking at this as being, you know, his reaction to racism in America, and, you know, it was all justified. But I couldn't get over, when I was reading this, it just seemed to be a book of a serial rapist. I couldn't see that other side of it. But this was standard reading. After the rally in the park in Los Angeles, I decided to go back to Toronto and, you know, get involved there instead, you know, with the people who maybe I was more familiar with. I went back and joined an organization there called Black Youth Organization, which worked with the Black Students Union and University of Toronto campus. And, you know, being involved again, this was still an extension of communist politics with some element of nationalistic teachings, which is that we would focus on Black Canadians and try to elevate their consciousness towards the oppression which existed. But again, I found myself in a situation where it was mainly students and young people talking to young people. You know, we weren't really affecting anything in the society. And I could say probably my biggest exposure here was to further reading to books of famous writers of the past. Probably the most striking thought that I can remember from that era was that of a writer, Frederick Douglass, who back in the 1800s, he was a black man who had been freed and was quite outspoken for the cause of black people in America. He had made a statement that the limits of oppressors are defined by those who they oppress, where he put the responsibility on the oppressed, that they are the ones ultimately that define how much they will be oppressed. That left an impression on myself, in that it sort of indicated that the state of a people is determined by their own consciousness. If they don't want to be free, if they don't want to be liberated, they don't want to be educated, then they won't be. You know, you really can't make people free. People have to want to be free. During this period, I had some exposure to Islam. We had a standard movie that everybody had to watch, known as the Battle of Algiers, which documented the Algerian struggle for independence. And of course, the battle cry during that struggle was Allahu Akbar. You know, there were women wearing hijab and hiding weapons under their outer garments. And, you know, so there was something of Islam there. Then I also came in contact with the black Muslims, Elijah Muhammad's followers. I went to the States again and visited some of their temples. But though I was impressed by the discipline that they had, in terms of the personal discipline, outwardly anyway, this idea that God was a black man, just I'd given up the idea of God anyway, you know, becoming a communist, but then the idea that God was a black man who should be worshipped became even more ludicrous to me. So I didn't find really anything attractive about Islam at that period, and I just continued to be involved in the activities of this this organization. I continued to play music. At the time, I used to play in nightclubs and for rallies, you know, to raise money also for the activities of the organization. But slowly again, I found myself in a state where I didn't see any future in what we were doing. We were not affecting any major change in the society. It seemed really not to be going anywhere. At this time, what struck me was a movement in South America. I think they were called the Tuparemos, or Tupamaros, or something like this in Argentina. They were urban guerrillas. You know, they had taken the struggle to the streets, you know, fighting the government directly. And there were movements in the States like the SDS, Students for Democratic Society, who were taking that route also. So I thought it seemed like that's the only thing that was left, you know, to be talking and rallying. This didn't seem to be going anywhere. The only thing left was now to take the battle to the streets. So I decided to apply to go and study urban guerrilla warfare in China. And I went to the Chinese embassy in Ottawa, because Canada maintained relations with China during this period. And I went to see the ambassador and the person in charge of education, etc., to make this application. What struck me was the person who came to me was a chain smoker. I mean, he was smoking the whole time. And these cigarettes without filters even, you know, very strong cigarettes. But the whole time, every cigarette was finished, he'd started the next one. And to me at that time, the idea of control of cigarettes and drugs and these type of things, I thought it was important. And this sort of struck me as something which wasn't very good, because here was a person who was supposed to be a representative of the revolution, and he had no personal discipline. At any rate, I filled out my application. They told me, you know, we'll send you word as soon as the okay comes. I went back to Toronto and waited. This was over the Christmas holidays of 1971. And at this point, what I found was that when I got back to Toronto, that a good friend of mine who was in the leadership committee of this organization, which I belonged to, had accepted Islam. She became the wife of a known speaker today, Dr. Abdullah Hakim Quick, who is involved in lecturing in different parts of the world. I think he has come to Australia before. In any case, his wife, who was a good friend of mine, had accepted Islam. And this caused me to say, well, let me have a look. Because she was perhaps an even more fervent communist than I was. She was a Maoist, you know, which is like the extreme wing at that time. She had virtually memorized Mao Zedong's Red Book, you know, would be able to make quotes anytime quotes were needed. from Mao. So for her to convert, it struck me as something, there's got to be something behind this. So I asked her for some books and I began to read. The first book I read was called Islam, the Misunderstood Religion. And this is written by Muhammad Qutb. And this book basically was a comparison between Islam and all of the other systems that were out there, Christianity, communism, capitalism, socialism, from a social point of view, a political point of view, economics, you know, from all of the various aspects. And after reading that book, actually, I was convinced that Islam really had the best program for human society, for establishing justice, etc., in human society. I continued to read towards understanding Islam by Maududi and other books, and I became more and more convinced of that reality, that Islam really did have the best program, but the concept of God, the concept of God was something which just didn't reappear, you know, merely because you would like to believe, you just start to believe. Having denied God for some years before, it would take some time before belief in God was something which became a part of my life again. And actually the turning point for myself, you know, having reflected and discussed, etc., about God and belief in God, it came for me at a time when in the commune in which I lived, I had it in my own room, and I had a lot of books, and sometimes people would come in and borrow the books and read them in my room. I didn't allow people to take them out of the room. They would come in and read them, sit at my desk and read. And one occasion I was lying on my bed, and some people had come in, were sitting at the desk reading, and I'd gone into a state which was sort of between waking and sleep. I was aware of the people in the room, but yet I was dreaming. And I saw myself going into this warehouse with a bicycle of mine. I was walking it into this warehouse. And the further I went into the warehouse, the darker it got. And I started to get this feeling of fear because of the fact that, I guess I had a fear of darkness, but the further I went in, the more this feeling started to overcome me that perhaps I may not be able to get out of this place. I would continue to turn back to make sure that the entrance through which I came was still there. And each time I turned, I could still see it, though getting smaller and smaller. Eventually, I turned around and there was no entrance. I was in total blackness. And I got this fear, which basically was saying to me, if you don't get out of this, you will never get out. It was, I guess, a fear of death or whatever, but I was just overwhelmed by it. And I wanted to get out, so I started to scream. I was aware of the people in the room. I started to scream out to them, help me, but words wouldn't come out. They were stuck in my throat. So they couldn't hear me. I wasn't able to get out of the situation. I kept screaming. Until I reached the point I realized there was no way out. I was lost, totally. And at the point when I realized this and I gave up, I woke up. And I sat and thought about this. That to me, it was like confirmation that there was a force beyond me. Confirmation of the existence of God in that I wasn't able to get myself out of that situation. The people in the room were not able to help me. That were it not for that which was beyond me, getting me out of that situation, I couldn't have. So that had a marked effect on me. Shortly after that, I decided to accept Islam. And when I was taught how to pray, the sujood in particular, I realized that my adopted brother was a Muslim. At that point, I mean, I was happy on one hand, but I was shocked on the other hand. that he had understood all of this and had all of this all these years and had never said anything. I went out to Ottawa because my parents were there and he was there studying with my parents in university. He was very happy to see me. I was happy but upset. You know, I was upset with him because I told, why? All these years you're with us, you never said anything. You know, he said that, you know, he felt embarrassed because for him to say anything to us that might influence us to become Muslims, he felt it would be a disservice to my parents who had helped him. And, you know, he just felt shy about causing any problems in the family. But I told him, you know, of course, that he has an obligation to God, you know. And that obligation is above all else. If he had that knowledge, he should have shared it with us, given us the ability or the right to make the choice for ourselves. At any rate, after that, I returned to Toronto and began to study Arabic and Islam. I continued to play music for a little bit. Nobody told me it was haram or forbidden, but I just, at that point, you know, I found myself there in nightclubs playing with the other members of the group. Everybody else in the group is high on drugs. And, you know, I'm playing into a club where everybody there is drunk. And, you know, it's like I was in another world. I was amongst them, but I was not a part of it, you know. And the corruption that was there was so obvious to me. I felt myself out of place. You know, I shouldn't be here. So, you know, it wasn't too long after that that I decided to just pack it in. I sold all my musical equipment, records, everything, and just, you know, got out of it and started to focus on studying Islam. At this point, I traveled to England. I joined the Jamaat Tabligh because they were the most active Islamic group at the time. There was a particular individual known as Colonel Saab or Colonel Amiruddin from India, who was very, very vibrant personality, you know. And he took a group of us to England for the first major ijtima there called the Sheffield Ijtima. And I spent about 3 months in England with the Jamaat Tabligh. I was going there for 7 days. This was initially what my commitment was, 7 days. But, you know, they have a way that they make you make sacrifices that you don't necessarily want to make at the time. So I ended up being there for almost 3 months. And I was married. Actually, I was married about 3 weeks before I went off on this 7-day trip. And, you know, they would, in the gatherings, they would, you know, point me out and say, look at this brother. Look at the sacrifice that he made. You know, he just got married. He's out with us, you know, and he's spending this time, and he's going to spend even more time. And of course, after saying that, you know, I was obliged to spend, you know, another couple of weeks, you know, till eventually it became 3 months. My wife is writing me frantic letters, you know, if you don't come back. Finally, you know, I managed to extricate myself and get back before my marriage was destroyed. At any rate, that was a learning experience for me. You know, I had gone there with the intention of increasing my knowledge about Islam. Alhamdulillah, Colonel Amiruddin taught me tajweed, proper recitation of the Quran. And I had been told there that in England, you know, in the many mosques that they had in England, there were scholars in each mosque there who you could learn with. So wherever I went, whenever we stopped at any of the mosques, I would sit under the scholar there and take my notes, asking questions, etc. And I came back, and when I came back to Canada, I announced to my wife that we are now Hanafis. And she said, what is a Hanafi? Well, I explained to her that, you know, we are Hanafis, you know, because the Jamaat was teaching that, you know, of course, you had to follow a madhab. You had to follow one of these schools of Islamic law. And though they're all the same, you know, somebody will come along and tell you, well, you know, the greatest imam was Imam Abu Hanifa. You know, he was the first. Most Muslims are Hanafis. So then we're all Hanafis. So that's the best thing to be. So then I became a Hanafi and informed my wife that she should be a Hanafi also. Whilst I was there, I also learned the prayer for women, because the Hanafis teach a separate form of prayer for women. So it's a quite a tricky form of prayer. I don't know if there are any Hanafis in the audience here, but if a woman has to learn how to pray, if she hasn't learned how to pray the Hanafi way for women, special prayer, it's quite tricky. It involves a certain, gymnastic ability to some degree. And at any case, I learned it so I could teach it to my wife, and I taught it to her. And after that, we moved and we're living next to the masjid in the house of a brother. We had rented an apartment. His brother Mahmoud Khayal, who was originally from Egypt. His father had been a scholar in Egypt and was part of the Ikhwan movement, one of the students of Hassan al-Banna. And I started to learn Arabic from him and fiqh. We started to look at the books, and he was explaining to me different things. And then I started to find these discrepancies between what I was now learning and what I had learned when I had gone on Jamaat Tabligh. Of course, he was from the Shafi'i school of thought, and he explained that this is the Shafi'i position and here's the evidence for it, etc. And I started to see these differences, which led me to believe that I needed to go and learn Arabic thoroughly and study Islamic law from the sources myself. So I applied to go and study in Saudi Arabia to University of Medina, and I was accepted there and began to study. I completed a BA in Usul al-Din, or Islamic Studies, and following that I went to Riyadh and did a Master's in Islamic Theology. When I went to Riyadh, my parents actually were there before me. They were there teaching, because after having left Malaysia, they came back after I left, came back to Canada. From there they went to Nigeria, to northern Nigeria, where they taught for some years. They went to Yemen after that, and then they came out to Riyadh and had began teaching there at a school called the Minaret Schools. And I was invited whilst doing my master's to start teaching their Islamic studies. So I took on this responsibility of teaching students, mainly who were expatriates, because it's an English medium, expatriates working there. Their parents had studied in America or England, and wanted their children to continue in English medium. Most of the students were Western, from Western background. So the previous Islamic studies teacher was originally from Pakistan. They brought him there to teach. The students just wore him down. You know, they were thoroughly Westernized, and you know, he just couldn't handle them, because in Pakistan and India, students are quiet. You know, the teacher speaks, the teacher comes in, everybody stands up, and they're quiet until the class is over. Whereas people in America, you know, they've learned this there's a sort of rebellious kind of attitude amongst the students. They like to talk in class, and you know, if they find a teacher is weak and doesn't, you know, have a strong personality, then they'll just chase them out of the classroom, whether by throwing spitballs at them or whatever, you know. At any case, this individual, he didn't last more than half a term. You know, he packed his bags and left, so they asked me to step in. And of course, having come from a Western background, I really knew how to deal with his students. So we developed a good rapport, and I continued to teach there. And in the course of teaching, of course, I came to realize that there was a major lack of materials in English to convey the type of basic information which I felt needed to be conveyed about Islam, which was not from a particular madhab point of view, but an open approach to the presentation of Islamic teachings. So it required me to start to do a lot of writing, preparing notes for the students, and eventually I prepared some books and tried to publish them back in 1981, but I wasn't successful, couldn't find a publisher. And it wasn't until about 1985 that I published the first two books. One was called Polygamy in Islam, and the other one was called The Devil's Deception of the Shia. I mean, these two books were addressing particular problems which existed at that time in America. Polygamy from the point of view that when a person is a Muslim or a convert Muslim, the first thing that non-Muslims like to ask is, why do Muslim men have four wives? You know, this was the first question. So I felt it was important to write something on that topic. And the other problem was that of Shiaism, which was being promoted, because this was after the revolution in Iran, was being promoted very strongly in America amongst convert Muslims. Now, this was an unfortunate situation, because the revolution, on one hand, was claiming that we're all the same, we're all Muslims, you know, no difference between Sunni and Shia and so on and so. But at the same time, the Shiites would focus on Muslims to convert them to Shiaism. You know, so it seemed to me to be definitely a devious approach. Because on one hand, they were saying there was no difference, but on the other hand, they were trying to convert ignorant Muslims to Shiaism, as opposed to going to non-Muslims and clarifying for them what Islam was. During this period, I also began to, once I finished my master's at Imam Ibn Saud University, or King Saud University, I began to a PhD in University of Wales. And the focus of my PhD was that of exorcism in Islam. A lot of people were asking me, why exorcism? You know, couldn't you find anything else to write about? Now, what for me, I began this study of exorcism, which involved, you know, traveling to different parts of the Muslim world and investigating, because it was something which was out there, which, though I had studied all the way up to a master's level, I really didn't get a clear picture as to what was involved, you know, what is the rights and the wrong with regards to exorcism. So I decided to make that my focus for the PhD. And at the same time, I felt I wanted to utilize it as a means to provide in the Orientalist circles material which was authentic on the spirit world of Islam, you know, the human spirit, the world of the jinn, the world of the angels, because this would become a major part of the thesis. Because anybody researching today the spirit world in Islam, what they find is the writings of Orientalists, in which they have gathered the folk tales and myths of Muslim peoples from all around the world, and they've presented this as being the Islamic view of the spirit world. But in fact, it's a lot of confusion, and anybody studying it would think that, come out thinking that Islam has got a very confused concept of the spirit world. So I felt that this thesis would also provide this foundation. Now, whilst doing the PhD, the Gulf War came up. And prior to the Gulf War, I was invited out to the base in Dhahran. So it was the Saudi Arabian Cultural Information Tent. There we provided information about Saudi Arabian culture, which of course, much of which is from Islam. So it meant explaining things about Islam. And we took the troops into the city. We helped them purchase things. We showed them different aspects of Islamic society. We took them into mosques, etc. And in the course of 6 months before they were all processed out of the country, alhamdulillah, more than 3,000 of them had accepted Islam. And following that, I joined the Saudi Arabian Air Force headquarters in Riyadh in the Islamic Affairs Department, and continued to do work amongst the Americans, military people who were in the country. And I went to United States with the American military and helped them set up an organization known as the Muslim Members of the Military, which established places of worship and little libraries in all of the major bases, American bases across the world. And the whole momentum for Islam within the military picked up to such a point that within 2 years after that, the first Muslim chaplain was designated for the military, the army, and then a Muslim chaplain from the Navy, and now they're looking for one from the Air Force. And Islam has continued to grow in leaps and bounds within the military. Following that, I transferred, I continued with them for 2 years, and then I transferred to the UAE, United Arab Emirates, where I joined up with a charitable organization there by the name of Darul Birr, and set up for them a da'wah center in Dubai, where I have with me four other brothers and sisters who are involved in da'wah. And alhamdulillah, it has been quite successful. We have an average of about a person daily accepting Islam, most of which are from the Philippines, but we have a large number also from India, from Hindu and Christian backgrounds, as well as Americans, because American ships, Navy ships, come through there. And we have a channel, a network of people who are helping us. We work with the taxi drivers. Many of the taxi drivers are from Pakistan, Patans. And when they drive anybody who questions or asks them anything about Islam or anything to relate to Islam, they immediately bring them to our center so we can provide information for them. A number of them also carry pamphlets inside of their taxis. I've also been involved in giving lectures about Islam on television, on Sharjah television, as well as Ajman television, two television stations there in the UAE. And I set up a department of foreign literature in Sharjah for the publication of Islamic materials, which on one hand supports the Dawah Center, pamphlets for distribution, as well as continuing the publication process which I began in Saudi Arabia of trying to produce good material in English which conveys the body of Islamic knowledge which is available in Arabic. And at the same time, I also began to teach at the American University in Dubai, which is an American university, very Western. Students there are very Westernized. And I'm teaching a course called Introduction to Islam. It is, again, an issue of da'wah, or explaining Islam to students. Many in my class may be Muslims, but the vast majority of them don't pray or fast, these type of things. So for them, many of them have taken this course as like an elective, thinking that it would be an easy few credits, only to find me there, you know, shaking them up, you know. And alhamdulillah, it's been a good experience. A number of them, after, you know, the term's been over, have come and told me, well, you know, we started praying now, you know, we appreciate what you had said to us. And so this is basically the activity that I'm involved in at present, you know, not, of course, to mention lecturing in different parts of the world, here as well as Philippines, Malaysia, England, etc. So from that path which I've outlined to you, which is not only my way to Islam in the sense of my conversion, but my way to understanding Islam, because coming to Islam didn't end with conversion, but has been a continual process after accepting Islam, a continual process of education, continually increasing my knowledge, and also sharing that knowledge with others. This process, or this path, we can see, began in a state of ignorance, where the only images of Islam were very distorted images. There were contacts during that path with Muslims, but those Muslims had no effect on my life because either one, they were not practicing Islam as it should be practiced, or because they didn't feel a responsibility to carry the message of Islam to the non-Muslims around them. As such, it would be my advice then to those of you who are Muslims in the audience to know that it is a responsibility on yourselves to live Islam, whether you may have enough knowledge to propagate it and explain it to others. At least by living Islam, by being examples of Islam, you may give others who are non-Muslims an opportunity of being exposed to Islam, whether it's in a work situation, whether it's at school, with your neighbors or whatever, this is a continual responsibility that you should feel ashamed if you are not involved in. You should feel sinful because, in fact, you are in sin if you do not share this information. Because to have knowledge of God's revelation and to not share it with others around you to the degree or to the ability, to the level of your own ability, this in fact is a crime. This is a sin. And for those of us who have sufficient knowledge to convey it and to propagate it, it is very important for us to be actively involved in this matter, to work together where others may help us, because it's always difficult when one is on one's own, when one is by oneself, to have the courage to share. But when we are with others, when there are others who are supporting us, encouraging us, then it becomes a lot easier. So I would hope that out of this, you all would reflect on this responsibility. And for those of you who are non-Muslims in the audience, I hope you are not offended by anything I said. If you are Christians, you know, I'm just telling it like it was for me. I'm not saying that every Christian experienced what I experienced, but I know, even till today, Christianity for most people tends to be very nominal. We are Christians because our parents were Christians, but what it means to be a Christian, few people really know. And as such, I would invite you to look at the teachings of Islam and see what it has to offer, because Islam in no uncertain terms represents the way of life which Prophet Jesus himself brought, but which became distorted and diluted to the point where it has very little effect on the lives of Christians today. And with that, inshallah, I will conclude my speech, hoping that, as I said, I didn't offend anybody in sharing with you my own experiences, and hoping that it has been of some guidance or enlightenment to. Alhamdulillah, wassalatu wassalam ala rasulillah. All praise is due to Allah, and may Allah's peace and blessings be on the last messenger of Allah. I have many questions, and I know at the same time we have about 15 minutes. Oh, 50 minutes. Okay, that sounds a little better. Right? So we'll try to answer. Still, I don't even know if 50 minutes will be enough to deal with all of them. But we'll try to cover as many of them as possible. I will focus first on those that are directly related to the talk, and then go to those that were side issues, which maybe were implied by the talk, and then those which really have no relevance to the presentation at all. Okay, some direct ones. What effects did Islam have upon your parents and family? Can you tell us whether your family members converted to Islam or not? What happened with regards to my immediate family is that my parents accepted Islam in 1994, that is 3 years ago. They accepted Islam, and I accepted Islam in 1972. So what we're talking about is 22 years. And so this is like advice also to those who may have accepted Islam also and are trying with their parents and feel very frustrated, you know, that parents are not responding, that one has to be patient. You know, when they're ready, then they will accept Islam. If it is that they want the truth for themselves to live according to that truth, our duty is only to convey that message to them and to ask God to open their hearts And we have to be patient. We have to show them, not only in our words, what Islam is, but we also have to show them, more importantly, in our deeds. The question with regards to my name, you're called Abu Amina. You know, Abu Amina means the father of Amina, meaning that my eldest child, her name is Amina. So I took the kunya or pet name, Abu Amina. The name which I chose was Bilal. My family name, Phillips, some people question, well, why are you keeping this family name, Phillips? You know, it's not an Islamic name. Well, according to Islamic law, when a person accepts Islam, they may change their given name, but the family name should not be changed because it represents one's family. When a person becomes a Muslim, it doesn't mean that they no longer are part of the family that they were born into. They're no longer the son or daughter of their parents. So it is not permissible that the family name be changed, regardless of what that family name is. We know when we speak of Prophet Muhammad, may God's peace and blessing be upon him, we refer to his grandfather, Abdul Muttalib, which it means the slave or worshipper or servant of Al-Muttalib, an individual Al-Muttalib, which is, as a Muslim, an unacceptable name. One may not choose this name. To call oneself Abdul Muttalib is a forbidden name. But if that's the name of one's parent, then we're not allowed to change that name. My name prior to Islam was Dennis, and this name I could not keep. There's some non-Islamic names or non-Arabic names which a person may have, John, for example, you know, it doesn't have any bad meaning, so one can keep a name like this, or Mary, you know, or other names from which may be found in the Bible, or whose meaning is not bad. One is not required to change even the given name. But where the name has a bad meaning, for example, for women, the name Diana, for example. Diana is the goddess of love in Greek, Roman mythology. So for a Muslim to have this name is not acceptable. Similarly, Dennis comes from Dionysius. Dionysius is one of the Greek gods of party. So it's not an acceptable name, so I changed this name. But, you know, I remain Bilal, the son of Bradley Phillips. My father's name is Bradley Phillips, and so my name has remained as such. Now, with regards to the rest of members of my family, my brother and sister, who are non-Muslims, neither have accepted Islam. However, the other two members of the group that I was in Sabah, so many years back, I came to find out last year when I went to Sabah that both of them also accepted Islam. They had accepted Islam on their own. One of them had come to Australia and accepted Islam here in Australia, and the other one had accepted Islam there in Sabah. So last year was quite a nice reunion for me with my old friends. Actually, what happened was I was giving lectures in Abu Dhabi, in the UAE, and one of the people who attended the lectures there had gotten some of my books and took them back to Sabah. He was from Sabah. And when his brothers and sisters saw these books and saw the name on it, Phillips, born in Jamaica, from Canada, so and so, they said, I wonder if it's the same, you know, Dennis Phillips who we used to know. So he asked him to come back and ask me. And of course, when he asked me, I told him, yes, I was. And you know, they were quite overjoyed to hear that I'd become Muslim, and they invited me to come down there for a series of lectures. One of them had become the head of the Inosaba Securities, Islamic Securities organ there in Sabah. And my old classmates, we had quite a reunion, all my old classmates and friends. Some of my non-Muslim friends I had a chance also to sit with and try to give them some encouragement to reflect on Islam with the idea of possibly accepting it. There's a question regarding my acceptance of Islam. One person questioned the issue of using the term convert to Islam. I know there is something of a debate about whether we should say revert or convert. And I found it to be really something of semantics. I left what I believed in, or a way of life which I had inherited, and chose another one. Whatever you want to call it, that's what I did. Another person asked, well, what did you know about Christ before you became a Muslim? To be honest, not very much. Beyond that he was the Son of God, and he was God. As I guess most Christians tend to know, I came to know more about Christianity after having become a Muslim and looking at it again, you know, what its beliefs were, etc. There was another question, why it was that I chose Islam and not seek my answers in Christianity. Well, because I had left Christianity because of the fact that what I knew of Christianity didn't address social ills in terms of dealing with society from a governmental point of view, etc. There was no economic system or anything. I mean, it's just beliefs, an issue of beliefs. You know, they may be nice moral beliefs, etc., but they don't address the world. It is leave unto God what is God's and unto Caesar what is Caesar's. This is the approach, which is not a practical approach in terms of changing society. So I knew that the answers in terms of systems wasn't there in Christianity. This is why I didn't go back to seek those answers, because having converted to communism, I did have a look at Christianity at the time, and in terms of what systems had developed out of it, and really the conclusion which the Marxists had made, that religion is the opiate of the masses or the people, was drawn from the example of Christianity in Europe and how it was applied, that it was a means of convincing the ignorant masses that their reward is in the next life. Don't worry about this life. The rulers who are over you are by God's will. They are in fact closer to God. It's possible if you have more money to buy tickets to paradise, known as the indulgences, which the Pope used to sell during the Middle Ages. I mean, this whole tradition led these philosophers to conclude that religion was the opiate of the people. And that tradition, Christian tradition, remains the same till today. It doesn't address the ills of society in a solid and reliable way, from my experience. I see it modifying itself with the times, so much so that we now have in different parts of America, you know, homosexual priests, you know, homosexual congregations, you know. This is homosexuality, which was an abomination in Christianity in earlier times, has become acceptable in the eyes of many Christians today, Christian leading religious people. You know, there is this backtracking, there is the stability of concepts are even questionable. So, I would say that I've understood more about Christ and Christianity, having become a Muslim, than I ever understood as a Christian. And I have no qualms in saying that the only way that a person may truly follow Jesus is to become a Muslim. I've written a book called The True Message of Jesus Christ. It is available, in which I have gathered research to that effect, to show from scriptures, Islamic, as well as from Christian scriptures, that the message which Jesus brought was Islam, submission to the will of God. And that his way, the way which he invited people to, was the way of Islam. And that he himself was in fact a prophet of God and not God. What do you like about Islam in simple terms? The completeness. That it is a total system. It is a way of life which governs all aspects of my life. It provides guidance for me in a world of darkness. Prior to Islam, I know I was stumbling about, not knowing which way I was going, just whatever came up, I check this out, check that out, you know, stumbling, bumbling, back and forth. Islam provided stability, provided a clear picture with regards to what this world is about, where I should be going, and what my goals should be. So it has given me inner contentment. I don't feel at ease that I still have to go and find. No, I feel that I've found the truth. And I really have no doubt about it. I tried to study it as deeply as I could, not merely accepting it and just going along with what everybody said, but having studied it academically. I really, as I said, have no doubts about the fact that Islam is the way of life which God has prescribed for human beings. A question regarding the soldiers as to why so many of them accepted Islam. The fact is that there were many reasons. Some of it was that they were exposed to Islamic society or Muslim society, which, I mean, though it has its weaknesses, no one is saying that Saudi Arabia is the ideal Muslim society. It may be quite far from it, but there are strong elements of Islam there in the society. And this had an effect on a number of the soldiers. Some of it may be from the very customs of the people. I know a number of them told me that when they were out on the desert in maneuvers, you know, with their full battle gear and everything, they'd be out on the desert and they would come across a tent with a few camels, an individual Bedouin out there on the desert. And the first reaction they expected was that this person would run in horror from them. You know, they were all geared down with all their stuff. But they found instead that the individual would beckon to them to come over. Come and sit down. And they would come up, sit down. You couldn't distinguish the men from the women. You know, everybody's all geared down. And he would strike up the fire and put on some tea, offer them some dates. Of course, he couldn't speak any English. They couldn't speak any Arabic. He would just smile and offer them and so on and so. And they were amazed, you know. Here, you know, it's just, I know a number of them said this to me. It just struck them, you know, this generosity and kindness that was there, you know, which they said that they never experienced. You know, having been in a number of other parts of the world, in Korea, in Japan, in Europe, you know, different places that they were stationed, they never found this kind of friendliness and openness, you know, amongst the people. So I know this really struck them, a number of them. Others had been exposed to Islam in one way or another in American society. They had a lot of distortions, and so we had open sessions where people could ask any questions they wanted to, and so a lot of clarification was there, which helped to let them understand what Islam really was. There were some who were impressed by the security which was there in the society. You know, they used to come into town late at night when they're off duty, 1 o'clock in the morning, and they could walk around without a sense of fear that, you know, they're going to be attacked, you know, somebody's going to rob them, whatever. And this had an impression on a number of them. They, back in America, they know they could never do this. You know, walk around at that type of night, you know, wearing any kind of jewelry or anything like this would be putting oneself in a life-threatening circumstance. For others, there was the executions. I know some people might say, this is horrible, you know, because they were, people were being executed, the public executions that take place there. The crime is read out and, you know, people observe somebody's head being cut off. For some people, that was something which made them want to question, want to understand more about Islam, you know, this sort of direct justice, you know, where a person kills somebody and they're executed, finished. They don't languish in jail for many, many years, people's taxes having to pay for them, provide them with television, comfortable living for, you know, 30, 40, 50 years. But this idea of the eye for the eye made sense to them, and it attracted them. For a number, it was the issues concerning women. You know, many coming there had the impression that women are, you know, so oppressed in Islam. And also seeing the women wearing these abaya, the black abayas, you know, totally covered walking through the streets. The troops had developed a title for them, you know, as you have UFOs, unidentified flying objects. They call them the UBOs, right? The unidentified black objects, you know. So, you know, they were curious as to, you know, what was behind all of this. So, for a number of the women, they were taken into Saudi homes and they got to meet Saudi women and discuss with them. So they were educated, could speak with them, etc. And they came to understand that Islam's position was one of protection as opposed to one of oppression. For some, it was the issues of prayer and how the prayer was. That when the time for prayer came, the stores all closed and people went to prayer. A number of them had been told that the mosques were off limits, they shouldn't, you know, go near them. But, you know, we invited them to come to the mosque, we took them in, let them go and see what's inside the mosque, you know, because by telling them it was off limits, it sort of left it as a big question mark in their minds, you know, what goes on inside there. So it was quite impressive for a number of them to come in and see. It was such a simple kind of atmosphere. There were not a whole bunch of pictures and statues and things like this, but just a carpet, you know, and they saw how the prayer was, etc. And this had an impression on a number of people who were there. For some people, it was an issue of religious discussion. You know, although in our main tent we didn't really entertain that much in the way of direct religious discussion. If the topic was light, we would give light clarifications. But if it got really heavy, people wanted to get into Bible verses and all this type of things, we had a second tent which was next to our main tent. The main tent, which was quite large, about 200 used to come in at a time, and we'd have these open discussions. Then we had this separate tent when the people decided they want to get into this deep, you know, theological debates. We tell them, okay, listen, you know, this is a light discussion. If you really want to get into deep theology, then we have the other tent. You can go over into this other tent. Well, when they went into the other tent, they were greeted by this Sri Lankan brother, very tall, imposing brother with a big beard and usually wears sunglasses. You know, he looks like a holy man. You know, he has that holy man look about him. Who was originally, he had originally come to Saudi Arabia, you know, as a Christian missionary, you know, having studied, you know, and in a seminary, and having understood that the last frontier were the Muslims, right? And particularly the Arab Muslims. It's been particularly in the Gulf, in Saudi Arabia, because this is a place where it's just absolutely no conversions. So he was, you know, one of these kind of pioneering kind of souls. He felt, this is where I'm going. So he got a job as an accountant, because he had been trained accountant, but his real role there was missionary work amongst the Arabs. And when he got there, of course, he got himself a Quran because he felt he wanted to be fully versed. He had studied it when he was in doing his basic studies. When he converted, he decided to convert one of the organizations in Qasim, which is involved in explaining Islam to non-Muslims, took him out of his job, provided a source of income for him, and gave him a free hand to, you know, spread the word in different parts of Saudi Arabia, in the camps and various organizations that were available for conveying Islam to non-Muslims. Now he was, as I said, from a Christian missionary training. He had a good thorough knowledge of the Bible. And as such, he had the kind of background to deal with the issues that these people were bringing. He would wait for them there. He had two suitcases with him. He used to carry two suitcases around with him. And these two suitcases had in them about 40 different versions of the Bible. So when they would come in and sit down, he would open up his suitcase and say, well, which Bible do you want to discuss about? Many of them would say, what do you mean, which Bible? There's only one Bible. So he'd bring out for them and stack them all up and say, well, you know, we have this Bible and that Bible and the other Bible. You know, that was usually quite intimidating for many, you know. At any case, either he convinced them, you know, after some discussion, or they said, well, listen, okay, we don't have answers, but let's go get our chaplain. You know, he'll have some answers for you, questions, or answers to your questions. So they would go back and bring the chaplain. And alhamdulillah, in the course of discussion, 11 of the chaplains converted to Islam. So these were the basic circumstances under which Islam spread amongst the troops. Some of them, actually, there were other members of their families that were already Muslims. Now, they had curiosity, you know, they were quite open. And to be honest, actually, the vast majority of those who converted were Americans from a variety of different backgrounds, you know, a mixture of men, women, young, old, black, white. Actually, the percentage of white Americans who accepted was someplace around 35%, you know, which is much higher than those who would normally accept Islam in America itself. I mean, which really shows that if Islam is exposed to the American population as a whole, there would be a lot, you know, greater response to Islam in America. And we had people who accepted Islam who were Chinese Americans, Indian Americans. We even had some devil worshippers, you know, who had come, who accepted Islam, you know. Because actually, you know, the American military recognizes devil worship as a legitimate form of worship. And wherever there are chapels for the Christian sects, then there are chapels for devil worshippers on all American military bases. The reaction in the military, you know, amongst the chaplains was quite strong, you know, because the tent came to be known as the conversion tent, you know. You know. And they tried their darndest to get the military officials to stop or to make it off bounds to the American troops. But the big officers, etc., wouldn't agree with their suggestion because of the fact that they had such a large number of troops, and they didn't have for them the kind of R&R which they normally would have when they're in Japan or, you know, the other places where they could go to discos and, you know, and all these kind of things. These things were not available to them. You know, women, all this kind of thing, it's just not available. So if they didn't allow the troops some outlets, you know, which the troops wanted outlets, they wanted to find out about Islam, meet the people, and so on. So if they didn't allow this, they felt that the repercussions may be much greater, you know, that they may, you know, commit some crimes in the society and which would create, you know, major problems for themselves. So though I'm sure they were not necessarily happy about, you know, conversion of American troops to Islam, they really didn't have too many options given the circumstance, because after they left, you know, the according to American military records, you know, this is the first place that Americans' troops were stationed, and they left the country without any quote-unquote war babies. You know, war babies. Americans, when they came to the Asia for during the Vietnam War, they left behind, you know, in Vietnam, in Philippines, in Korea, in Japan, in Thailand, war babies. I mean, babies who are half American, you know, half of the locals. In fact, there's big cases going on in Philippines right now for the rights of these children. For the first time, they went into a country, 500,000 of them, and went out, and there were no war babies. In fact, the only pregnancies which they found were amongst the American troops themselves. You know, many of the women that were there went back pregnant. You know. So the tent was functioning right up until they left. And the American military continues to leave the door open for those military people who want to get information about Islam. The British military, on the other hand, were very closed. The officers would not allow us to go and speak with the troops at all. So there were very, very few British military people who accepted Islam. What happened also is that Hajj and Umrah was arranged for those who came. A number of troops were taken down to Mecca for Hajj and Umrah, and a system whereby American military transportation is provided for American troops in different parts of the world. They're flown into Dhahran, and from there the Saudi military have arranged for them to go yearly for Hajj. This is an ongoing process since that time. Some questions concerning school of thought, because I mentioned during the course of the lecture that initially I announced that I was a Hanafi. One person asked here, are you still a Hanafi? Or do you follow any madhab, I guess? Huh? And what did you find in your research about the different schools of thought in Islam? To which school of thought do you belong and why? Well, I consider myself a follower of all of the major schools of thought. The major school of thought meaning the school of Abu Hanifa, of Malik, of Shafi'i, and Ahmad ibn Hanbal, the major scholars of after whom the schools were named. I take benefit from the efforts that they have made, and wherever the authentic evidence supports their positions, that's what I follow. And this was the position held by themselves. Both Abu Hanifa and Shafi'i were both quoted as saying, إِذَا صَحَّ الْحَدِيثِ فَهُوَ مَذْهَبِي, that if you find the authentic tradition from the Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, may God's peace and blessing be upon him, this in fact is their madhab or school of thought. So I follow all of the schools without giving any precedence to one over the other, except with regards to where the evidence is. How do I look at them? As I said, I look at them as being the efforts of early Muslim scholars to apply Islamic law from its sources to daily life. They were human beings, as such, there were errors in their judgments, which even their own students rejected and corrected. And as such, we are obliged to take benefit from the efforts they made, to follow the rulings that they made where they're correct. But it's incorrect for us to blindly follow rulings, especially where we know that evidence indicates otherwise. Some questions concerning exorcism, because I mentioned my thesis was about exorcism. Do you have any practical experience in exorcism, that is, fixing people? Well, in the course of the study, you know, I did observe and practiced myself to within the bounds of what is Islamically acceptable. My thesis has been published, and it will be sent here. Should be available through your local organization, the brothers who have organized this lecture, probably within the next few weeks. Copies will be available, wherein I have identified the parameters of exorcism in Islam, what is acceptable, what is not acceptable. Because there is, of course, a huge tradition of practices which are found in different parts of the Muslim world, which have been attributed to Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, attributed to the scholars of Islam, etc., and portions of which are in fact not supported by the Quran and Sunnah, and represent sort of innovative practices which are not acceptable Islamically. So I've tried to identify the correct view with regards to exorcism. Now, the question which is also asked here, is exorcism permissible in Islam? Yes, as long as it stays within the bounds set by the Quran and the Sunnah, or the way of Prophet Muhammad, may God's peace and blessing be upon him. Some more general questions related to da'wah, I guess, to explaining Islam to others. I've got many non-Muslim friends, and I'm scared to tell them about Islam because they may not be interested at all. So what should I do? Well, we don't know what is in people's hearts. It's not our duty to convey Islam only to those who are interested. Those who have expressed interest, of course, then it is a direct requirement for us to convey that information to them. But whether a person expresses interest or not, it's still our duty to convey something of Islam to them. If they're not interested, then we've not lost anything. They say they're not interested, fine. We shouldn't feel embarrassed, we should present it in such a way that even the person we're trying to explain it to should also not feel embarrassed. We may pass that information on to them by the way of videotapes, by the way of audio tapes, by the way of pamphlets, etc. If we find difficulty out of shyness to try to speak to people, now we can give it to them in other ways. And we should live Islam ourselves by practicing Islam as it should be practiced. We will convey to them something of Islam, because we will stand out. A person who practices Islam in the 20th century will stand out from the rest of society. And those who want the truth, or who are concerned, who want to know, will raise questions. Question: to share Islam with non-Muslims, would we need to have a certain degree of knowledge about Islam? Well, of course, one should have some basic knowledge. I mean, one doesn't have to be a scholar having studied so many years, etc., etc. But one should have a clear understanding of the basics of Islam. And whatever we have of that basic knowledge, we can convey to others. If questions are raised which we can't answer, then we pause, turn it over to other people. We don't have to try to find answers. We shouldn't feel that if we're going to convey Islam, we must find an answer. We must be able to answer every question that people raise. No. We explain to them, well, you know, our knowledge is limited. We can find somebody, hopefully, who can give you further clarification. So, one should convey whatever knowledge one has. As the Prophet, may God's peace and blessing be upon him, had said, بَلِّغُوا عَنِّي وَلَوْ آيَةً. Convey for me whatever you know of Islam, even though it be only a single verse from the Quran. And with that, I've been given the T sign, which means time to close down. And I hope, inshallah, that what we have shared this evening, if there are some questions remaining which people didn't get answered, and there are, you know, questions about the Taliban movement and so on, so it's sort of far away from the topic. Inshallah, you can contact the people who have organized the program, and maybe you can call me by telephone, and I can try to answer whatever I could over the next few days that I'm here. Subhanakallahumma bihamdika, nashhadu an la ilaha illa anta, nastaghfiruka wa natubu ilayk. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.